The New York Times Book Review hailed Martin Gilbert's mammoth biography of Winston Churchill as a triumph. The latest volume, Churchill in America, documents Churchill's lifelong relationship with his mother's native land and his nation's most important ally. That relationship never mattered more than during the Second World War. Martin Gilbert told Steve Paulson what made Churchill such a great war leader.
He had relatively clear and simple ideas. He had a clear sense of right and wrong. I mean, he had a high moral sense. He wasn't interested in politics as such. He didn't like to play politics, and therefore he didn't need to dissemble. He didn't need to pretend he was doing something for a reason other than the reason he was doing it.
That's a remarkable thing to say. He didn't like to play politics when he spent virtually his whole life in politics.
I prefer to think that he spent virtually his whole life in the parliamentary system, or indeed in Parliament. He didn't get on particularly well with the party leaders or the party system. And in every party in which he served, and he changed parties twice, he went his own way and as a result was out of office for many, many, many years. I mean, when he was actually at the height of his powers, mental and physical, there was no place for him in government because he didn't toe the party line.
Was this specifically because of his warnings about Germany?
Entirely.
So for much of the 30s then, there was, well, I guess the word would be appeasement. There was this general sense that England should not confront Germany.
Yes, I think that appeasement was always rather a positive thing in the minds of the British leaders, Stanley Baldwin and then Neville Chamberlain, who succeeded him. Both men didn't see appeasement as something to do with fear or to do with capitulation. They saw it as some means of having Anglo-German cooperation. So this wasn't craven obeisance, it wasn't fear, it was hope and enthusiasm. And Hitler and his government played on that.
Now, this was, of course, before the Holocaust. I mean, the evils of Hitler were not quite so apparent.
The evils were not so apparent, but what marked Churchill out is that from 1932, before Hitler came to power, and throughout the period 33 onwards, he warned that Nazism was evil, that it wasn't just a different form of political system. It was a racist and evil system, and that it would seek to conquer Europe, even conquer the world, and that the plight of the Jews in particular was going to be horrendous.
What General Weygand has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
The enemies of Britain were at their most strong, and indeed all Britain's allies were destroyed and defeated, and Hitler conquered Norway, Denmark, Belgium, Holland, France. And Hitler really had nothing to prevent him from invading Britain or conquering Britain or undermining British morale, or physically destroying Britain by bombardment from the air, except this man who said, it doesn't matter whether we're destroyed or not. What matters is that we stand up for our values. At least give him a good run for his money. At least, you know, show that the democracy which we are and the human rights in which we believe have the power to defend themselves even against an overwhelming enemy.
Do you think most people in Britain in, let's say, 1940 and 41, assumed that Germany would defeat them?
They knew that Germany had the power to defeat them. And neither they nor Churchill himself knew how that defeat could be averted. But he said, let's try it, and they tried it. the public trusted him not to surrender unnecessarily. The public understood he will carry on for as long as it's possible to carry on, and we just have to hope, I suppose, for miracles. And there were various miracles, including the so-called miracle of Dunkirk, when hundreds of thousands of soldiers who were trapped and defeated managed to get off, managed to get back to Britain, of course, mostly without their equipments, which were left behind. But at least they were saved. Now, if for some reason they had been destroyed, if it hadn't been one of the calmest seas ever known in the North Sea, if it had been a rough sea, then they would have been lost. And perhaps the morale would have collapsed at that time. And people would have said, right, we've had enough. Churchill accepted that. And he always had one of his qualities in the war. It was a general quality. He believed in telling people the story as it was.
Our heavy bombers are striking nightly at the taproot of German mechanized power and have already inflicted serious damage upon the oil refineries on which the Nazi effort to dominate the world directly depends. We must expect that as soon as stability is reached on the Western Front, the bulk of that hideous apparatus of aggression which dashed Holland into ruin and slavery in a few days will be turned upon us. I'm sure I speak for all when I say we are ready to face it.
Which is not usually what we hear today, for instance. I mean, the way the war in Iraq is presented, for instance, I mean, we don't hear from our leaders about what's going wrong.
Well, you mention a point there which I think is also very important to Churchill's story. Leadership. He did lead. I mean, that was what he was capable of doing. Perhaps all his life had been a training for that, because he'd had many setbacks, he'd made many mistakes, he'd had many political setbacks, personal setbacks. But he was always prepared to give the lead. If you asked him a question, he'd give you an answer. People understood he is leading, he is trying to find a way out, a way forward. And that really was his great strength in 1940. People knew, well, this man is not going to be sort of hiding behind a curtain. He's not going to be asking other people, well, am I doing the right thing? He's going to find a way of leading. And people were prepared to follow him.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying, because in some ways, I guess, I would assume that the leader of a country has to rally the people of his country. I mean, what else is a leader supposed to do? And yet you're suggesting that Churchill did that, but a lot more. I mean, somehow the way he did that was extraordinary.
Yes, I mean, there is another factor in this, that normally you find yourself in a situation where, if you like, you're stuck with the leader. In other words, when 9/11 happened in the United States, there was already a leader, there was already a president, and he had to be a leader. You know, he could either be a good leader or a bad leader, but he was sort of in place. In the British case, in May 1940, he was chosen to lead in the most desperate time. And the other thing he did, which has, for example, not happened in the United States in either of your wars in Iraq, is that the first thing he did was to abolish party politics and create all-party governments.
Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed an administration of men and women of every party and of almost every point of view. We have differed and quarreled in the past, but now one bond unites us all: to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be.
In his governing cabinet, or whatever you call it in England, there were people of all parties?
People of all parties, and also people of no party, people of great quality. So if, for example, the current situation in Iraq, which is confronting America, if it is really a serious situation, and that may be a matter for debate, but if it's a really serious situation, then the equivalent of what Churchill did is that President Bush would bring in probably Clinton and Gore and three or four other leading Democrats, perhaps Senator Lieberman, and they would have equal power with Cheney and Rumsfeld and with the Republicans. And parties would simply cease to exist. Bush would say, right, I want the best people, you know, throughout the party spectrum. So it may be a question that the danger is not seen in America as being all that great. though it seems to me a crisis.
I think most people would say it's a crisis.
So then, you know, the equivalent of Churchill's leadership would be the president forming an all-party coalition. He would remain president. But republicanism and Democrat, they wouldn't be in the equation. They wouldn't be of interest to anybody. And certainly you wouldn't appoint somebody to any post who was merely a friend or a crony or whatever. You would appoint the person who was absolutely across the political spectrum the best person for that post.
So you're saying that the fact that he did that, that he essentially abolished the political party system during the war, really made a difference in how the country responded.
It made an enormous difference, and it meant that you didn't have one whole segment of your society denied the right to be responsible for aspects of war policy or war making. That is an extraordinary feature when you think of it. After all, war isn't just about jobs for the party boys, and it certainly isn't about profit making for the arms manufacturers. Churchill was very conscious of that, and he tried to create a unity across the social spectrum. So when you had leading Labour Party figures in very high positions in the government, then the public could be more satisfied that this isn't going to be a sort of cronyism war or a profit-making war.
The latest volume of Martin Gilbert's biography of Winston Churchill is called Churchill in America. Gilbert spoke with Steve Paulson.